hi everybody, I'm Mark Ciaffardini. I am here at the 20th anniversary of Fantastic Fest. Do you hear that? That's an echo. That means the things we're seeing now are now echoing in eternity. A lot like the movie that we're going to be talking about, Body Blow, directed and written by, even edited by Dean Francis?
That's right.
Dean Francis. And we're also here with his exceptionally beautiful, bright and charming and has a great Texas accent, Sasha Horler.
Hi.
Great to see you.
Hey, y'all.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I feel like you're...
I'm sorry. I just embarrassed myself. It's all right.
I do it all the time. Well, I have a... You could call this a Rosetta Stone. It makes sense to me. This is all the notes I was taking.
Wow, that's impressive.
From...
And usually, while you were watching it?
Yeah, while I was watching.
Wow, 10 points.
So usually I don't do that anymore because I used to be very like...
And then somebody... You missed the phone.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so now I've just sort of like take it all in. But I was like, I knew I needed to write some stuff down. So there's quite a few takeaways, mm-hmm. both visually, both narrative-wise, both acting. And I just want to jump into the one. What's the difference in your eyes between wanting to be cared for and looking for love?
In our movie.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a deep question to get started with.
I'm ready.
Wanting to be careful and looking for love. That's a great question. I mean, I guess that is kind of really at the core of what Aiden is. You know, he's looking for love in all the wrong places. But ultimately, I think that a really important decision we made, actually a little bit later in the production process, was to have we called it the domestic moment in the film. I guess I'm conscious of not giving too much away in terms of spoilers, but there is a moment where our two lead characters actually find themselves in Aiden's domicile, and there is, in fact, in one draft of the script, we actually went so far as to have a scene where like they made breakfast together because we wanted to just to have that moment of sitting down in the kitchen in the dining room. Which gives us this little glimpse of what the future mm-hmm. possibility could be. So that's that idea of having someone to kind of care for you.
Gotcha.
But of course, Aiden only you know gets to experience that in such a fleeting way. You know, right mm-hmm. At the end of the second act, and yet you kind of get the sense he's spent his whole life kind of searching for that, but he hasn't really had the means of identifying it because he's been looking for sex, instant gratification. And that kind of stuff. So I think that's actually a really interesting observation.
I think with the other characters, so, I mean, our lead character is Aiden, who's a cop who works for me in our undercover part of the police area that we're in, and he drives the story. But the other character, who is sort of the femme fatale, is Cody, who's a very beautiful, fucked up, drug-taking character, and they're both these lead men have trauma right up front. It's not hidden, they're very clear about it, which is sort of beautiful. And I think one of my favourite lines that runs through the script is about whether or not someone's boyfriend material, because, you know, it's kind of said in a joking way, but what it means is, are you worthy of love? Could you be more than just a fuck? Could you be more than just a one-night stand or, you know, something to get my rocks off on? And so I think what Dean's written for these characters is that they're both very frightened of opening themselves up to be possibly boyfriend material, meaning with vulnerability. You know, if you're just hooking up and taking drugs and moving on, then you're never, ever going to take a risk. Mm-hmm. So I think implicit in your question is what Dean's written is, when will these two fall in love? Will they? Won't they? But who's going to have the courage to be boyfriend material? And I think that's what's great about the tension and the response that we got from people on opening night was that they, and this is not spoiling it, they want them to be a couple. And when you watch that film, our film, and see how impossible, how many obstacles are in the way for them to even remotely get there, the stakes are so high, mm-hmm. it's life and death, literally, then it's very exciting to meet people after the film and I say, what do you think? And they say, they were together in this kind of emotional way. And I go, really? And they go, yes, yes. In a very, and there's nothing better when you're a performer mm-hmm. where someone's already personified a film they've seen. They're already invested so much that they know what happens during the credits. That mm-hmm. was, that for me was probably the best thing that about having a premiere with, you know, over 160 people, is hearing how invested people were in their relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And going back to what you said, Dean, about the glimpse, this is a comical parallel, but there's a part in Little Shop of Horrors where they kind of see themselves with the white picket fence, and it's a sort of glimpse into the future. So it's interesting that, you know, there was the idea of trying to show this, because it's like, hey, what could be? Mm. And I think of, you know, I think of movies like Million Dollar Baby or Mosquito Coast mm. or maybe even High and Low by Akira Kurosawa. And it's like, they're two different movies within the same movie. Like, one climbs, you're like, yeah, this is good. Oh, shit, this is going to be bad, you know? Yeah. And so, like, what Aiden and Cody fight together is, you know, they're trying to get out of their own way.
Mm.
And I think the other topic I'd like to touch on is how you view addiction, or just, like, you know, I think addicts are, you know, it's kind of got to be deep down in them who they are. And sometimes acknowledging who you are can also be like, you know, I'm, you know, what my sexual orientation is, what my religion is, what my, like, and just accepting that. And, you know, it may be to their detriment. You just have to kind of be who you are. So that's a lot. There's not even a question there, but just the idea of addiction and acceptance of that, you know, like, can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a difference between obsession and addiction. And I think that Aiden is almost kind of misdiagnosed himself as a kind of a sex addict
mm.
when really he just has to own up to the fact that he's like a sexually charged man with certain, you know, tastes and like aspirations.
Man. He hasn't even really acknowledged that to himself, has he?
I think he's not closeted or no. sort of confused about his sexual identity, but I think he feels a discomfort about the kind of social role that mm. he sees for like gay men, and the way that that in his view is in conflict with the expectations placed on him as a cop in terms of needing to be strong and masculine mm. and assertive and things like that. So he's still trying to work that out. But ultimately, I mean, it is a journey for self-acceptance, and it's certainly not one of these stories where, you know, oh, when is he going to realize he's gay?
Oh, no, that's the best part.
It's a lot more sort of going on than that. But I think for me, it encapsulates the final line of the film, I think, encapsulates it. And this was controversial when we were in script development, but I can probably say the final line of the
can
film.
You?
Well, maybe I shouldn't. But anyway, it's to do with the idea that I just want to fuck you, basically. and I think when the character is able to say this and acknowledge that's a fundamental part of, like, you know, what he wants and needs on an emotional level as well as a physical level, then that I think is the moment where he's come to terms ultimately with who he is. And even though he's in a perilous moment at the end of the film, I hope it gives us that glimpse of optimism
mm-hmm.
that he has kind of overcome mm-hmm. the things that are preventing him from, you know, becoming a whole person.
Yeah, and being sort of the third wheel, so to speak, in this relationship, you know, there's I think there is not one character who doesn't have an addiction. And it's a word that's bandied around, but what it means is there's something you can't give up.
Mm-hmm.
You've tried, you've had abstinence, you've had rehab, you've had time away from your work or whatever, but there's a point in your life where you know you're an addict. It's, you either know it publicly or privately. So even my character, who is a cop, is, I think, addicted to her own trauma story. It informs the fact that, you know, her mother died, she doesn't know how, her father's a corrupt cop who's been in jail for a long time. She just accepts that she's a fuck up. And that, in a way, is accepting that she's addicted to the dark side of being a corrupt cop. it's not as if we hadn't seen those people in films and books and literature before. But likewise, when you look at Cody, what I love about the way Dean writes these people is they never apologize. It's not that kind of cheesy, I wish I wasn't an addict. These people know who they are. Mm-hmm. They know that they need to keep taking drugs, or that they will or they won't. And there's no apology for it. And that's what I loved and do love about the film and the writing, is that no one's saying, oh, I hope I survive. They're just staying right in the middle of their addiction, mm-hmm. and living, which I think is more realistic in a way, because it's not a redemption story about someone going to rehab. It's about people who still try and love each other while addicted to stuff that they know isn't good for them.
And also, too, there's a lot of control happening. Yes. There's control between what you and your dad are trying to do.
Yeah.
To Aiden, daddy keeping Cody under, yes. lock, like literal lock. And yeah. so some of these things are inferred, and some of these things are actually like as subtle as a brick, you know, with the lock. So what was your vision for how much is on paper and implied versus you couldn't miss this if you tried?
I mean, I think when I was developing the script, you know, you start off with a whole bunch of kind of themes that you're really, really interested in. And then as you flesh out the story and the narrative comes together, and then as the actors, you know, come in and they have their own views on the detail and the backstory and the nuance, you find that certain of those themes you lean into like super hard. And you go, okay, the idea of, like, the visual motif of shooting through cages. You know, there's a lot of moments where Aiden is pictured behind wire or behind a cage, okay, or what nice. Have you. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, when he's working out in his, like, the first shot, I think, of the film rises up out of a kind of cage as Aiden's doing press-ups on the ground. And then, like you say, you've got the lock that Cody wears, the cock cage. You know, Fat Frankie's kind of whole armor, which is, you know, his drag outfit, is also another sort of form of cage. There's a massive cage in his bedroom. They just sort of stand out and kind of resonate with you. But all the other stuff that you haven't maybe leaned in and maybe, like you said, made it less subtle, is there as a texture, because it's come out of a personal place of being drawn to themes. And then, you know, we were lucky to have a rehearsal process, so then
which,
the
by the way,
actors
is extremely rare for film
thing.
I've been doing this for a long time, and back in the day you got, if you were lucky, 1 week where the director could push the rest of the production away and say, no, I'm not answering that, I'm just working with the actors. And now, with the pressure of time, money, or lack thereof, rehearsal just does not happen. It doesn't happen. TV rarely happened, but now it doesn't happen. So it was a luxury to have, I don't know, how long did we have?
A couple of weeks.
Yeah, on and off. We weren't living in Dean's house, you know.
But you kind of were, because we also had our film festival going on at the same time. We had a film festival in our production studio.
He wanted us to be there every minute of
every day.
Like, just leave us alone,
yes.
And wait till we shoot.
And then Friday was party night. We'd have Body Blow Party. So we had a great time, and we gave
party
ourselves...
Blow.
Party Blow. Exactly.
Also,
party
although
blow.
He was indoctrinating us in his aesthetic, that's for sure, but I did have to put my hand up and say, could we have one lesbian film, please? Because, you know, we were watching these incredible films that were giving us an idea of how saturated it would look and how graphic it was looking. I thought it was great.
And that's one thing I wanted to know... in Aiden's world, you could say it's very gray, literally gray. His headboard's gray. His whole room aesthetic's gray. And you don't really get the color and the timbre of what's happening until you get to the nighttime scenes. And even so far as to say the house is in his development. I expected almost this Tim Burton level of, like, every driveway had the same car, and it was like... blah. And then he comes alive when he comes into, you know, the other world, you know. So I was curious about how that aesthetic was intentional.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the film is kind of really like about opposites and about tension. I mean, like most films about conflict, inner conflict. So, you know, Aiden is kind of on the margin between, on one hand, kind of bland. But also, I don't know if you noticed another interesting detail about Aiden's location is it's actually like a really new housing development on the very far outskirts of Sydney. And even though it took us an enormous amount of time each day to travel out there, the reason we did is because it's actually on the very edge of like built suburbia. So beyond that is like the bush, you know, the Australian bush. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of on the margin of suburbia, sort of caught between this bland suburban world. And then when he goes into the city and explores the nightlife, of course, it's an overwhelming, hypersaturated world that is, you know, both enticing and, of course, really unsettling and, you know, is the thing that kind of really puts him under the pressure to confront ultimately that kind of inner conflict. So yeah, it was, and I mean, we really wanted to get that sort of claustrophobic suburban kind of energy.
Yeah, and his house looks like no one lives in it. Yeah. That's what, and even the cops kind of notice it. And even I notice it. It's like, it's too clean. You know, and there's a moment where he leans down and wipes some footprints off. And it's like, the house is reflective of his, again, need to control. Mm-hmm. And yes. it's control, that house. It doesn't have anything personal in it.
And except then, for one thing, which is the chickens.
Yeah.
Of course.
He likes chickens.
Or there's something funny about a cock in a cage.
Well, that's...
Sorry. Yeah, I picked up what you're putting down.
Yeah. But I think Dean and the DOP and the production designers and everyone worked really hard on that opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wrote here, ghosts of the past, brothel shot in the back of the head.
Mm.
So it's like controlling people with dirt on you. Mm. You know, it's less about a physical shackle. It's more of like, don't tell or I'm going to fuck you up, you know, like yes. that. And so these characters are interesting because it just shows you how intangibly, that's not even a word, how intangibly, like they have no other option.
Yeah, and everyone has got dirt on someone mm-hmm. in our movie. And I think someone wrote in a review recently, it's a cop movie in one respect. You know, it's about who's got the most dirt on someone and who can control someone with the information that will ruin them. But what I love about how Dean writes it is that is a form, you know, a trope, a cinema trope. But then we have a much more bended reality in there. You know, Fat Frankie is larger than life. You know, everything is pink and purple and, you know, saxophones. And what I love is how Dean's bent that stuff. But in terms of stakes, you can't turn left or right because you know that someone could fuck you up. So having dirt on someone means that everyone is compliant and constrained. That makes it made it tough to shoot. Everyone, you know, it's a stressful thing that every character knows there's someone who could dob you in,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm. Well, talk to me about the look of the film in terms of, I couldn't stop looking at Aiden and not imagine he was cast because it was like Jean-Claude Van Damme wish fulfillment. It's like he must have.
The poster everyone says is that Van Damme, right?
So did you just get lucky that way, like you know, and
with casting Aiden.
Yeah.
It wasn't. I don't think we got lucky. I think we.
He's a great actor.
Yeah, I think it was a deliberate thing to start off the process by finding Aiden and build the cast around mm-hmm. Aiden. I mean, the lucky thing for me was to come across Tim, who you know we'd been in each other's orbits for like years and years and years and years, but to come across Tim at the particular time in his life and career when he was really really ready to play this character, and. There were some factors like he had just only very recently come out as gay publicly, and he was in the process of really exploring himself creatively, and then we ended up that it was actually the production got pushed back by a few months at one stage, and that turned out to be a real blessing because it gave Tim the opportunity to really go there both in terms of emotionally to do the intellectual work about discovering the character, but of course also physically, and he did put in considerable work to appear in the character physically, as did Tom Rogers in the role of Cody. You know, we sent him to the gym for a number of months actually, and everybody. I mean, you did, got an undercut and dyed your hair pink. Everyone transformed.
Yeah, and also I have to say to Marissa, our makeup extraordinaire, it's one thing for you to sit with the director and go, yeah, I think I get what you want visually. We're working on a script. But the day when you all get your fucking hair done, and so, like, Tim gets a buzz cut and has been, like, working out. Tom, who's just got nice little plain brown hair, gets a full blonde mohawk. And then I said, well, if I'm going to be an undercover lesbian cop, she needs to be undercover out of cover. She needs to be really overt. So let's go tank girl pink, or let's do a proper lesbian undercut, and let's make her like overt in she's not hiding. She's saying, come at me. Mm-hmm. When the three of us saw each other on that day, we're like, there's the character. Oh my God. You've got no hair. Oh my God. You've got a mohawk and it's white. Oh my God. You know, and that's the fun stuff for an actor, because it's all intellectualized up until that point. You can rehearse in Dean's living room for as long as you want, but the day when you get transformed before you even put on your costume by your physical look, and Marissa did an incredible thing with all of us. You know, I had a really strong makeup look, and so did Cody, and then Tim's looking sort of buff and sexy and bronzy and everything. All of those things are really deliberate.
Well, talk to me about, because, you know, your character goes to the limit, or believes that there is no limits, in a way. So I'm curious, when you're working on the story, or when you're putting it in your head, from an individual standpoint in the film, but also you as a creative, do you have limits? Do you recognize your limitations? Like, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to look out for help outside, or...
Are you talking about performance?
It could be anything. It's like I'm trying to craft this grapefruit in a way to let you guys really explore it. But like the idea that, you know, you might have limits as a writer, you might have limits as an actor, but then also you like what your limits are, like how far you want to go, because you feel that that's appropriate for the scene, the setting, the story.
Well, I know as a performer, you have to have limits, because it's a film. And our job is to, we don't shoot in a linear fashion like a play. We have to keep, as Dean does, the story in our head every day when we jump from this scene, the end of the film, to the beginning of the film. That's our job, to serve the director's vision, to make sure that we're getting the story. It was very collaborative in that way. And certainly for me, it was really important that you shouldn't know who Constable Steele is. You shouldn't know who she is until the last minute of the film. And, you know, and I would say to Dean, is it still convincing? Do we still think she's a good girl? Because, of course, she's a baddie, but you don't find out how bad until the last 3 minutes of the film. And as an actress who's done that in theatre, it's really important you never play the end of a scene. You never play, you know, you can't play, hey, I could be corrupt. Because an audience is always two steps ahead of you. Well, they should be. They should be sitting there going, aha, I know what's coming. And actually, interestingly, some people said they had no idea which way Tim was going to go. You know, he was so pent up. You weren't sure what the character was going to do. Was he going to punch someone in the face, or was he going to arrest them? So in terms of that, if you're talking about shooting sex scenes and violence, thankfully, there is a new form in Australia and America, around the world, where we have intimacy coordinators. And there's a lot of bad press from older actors who are like, I don't need that. I came up. I can look after myself. But in fact, what they are advocates for the script. They want to make sure that Dean gets as much as he can, so that when he edits it, you know, that there is, it's there. But you can't push an actor to the point where they feel traumatized afterwards.
Okay.
Right? We're actors. It's a job. So you push yourself for your director. You push yourself for yourself to go as far as you can. But at the end of the day, it's still a job. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of get what I mean?
No, totally. There was an actor I was speaking to last night who was saying that his character was something he actually tried to get away from in his real life. And it kind of pushed him to something he was trying to get away, he didn't like. And it was weird for him because he was actually, during the shooting process, he was estranged from the rest of the cast. So it kind of put him even more of a dark place because he wasn't really, I mean, you know, if Darth Vader hangs out with Luke Skywalker on set, yeah, you know, there's no stakes. So, yeah. You know, so I get exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so I can see that, you know, less of a limit, like I'm going to ride this horse or I'm going to jump off this building versus, you know.
Well, when you're in the hands of a good director, what you're hoping is you give them 3 or 4 takes where they go further.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm.
You know, what you're hoping is in that moment, on that day, in that scene, you say, here, I think I've given you. And the director says, be braver. Mm-hmm. You give me one more. And you go, really? Ah, really? And they go, yeah, let's do one more. You know, it'll either work or it won't. That's the great thing about film, is it's contained. You just keep trying and then see what happens.
Yeah, and I think in the process as well, like the I think we did have a pretty close, the way that I remember it at least, I think I remember being very creatively close to the cast. And at one stage I was actually going to be the DP on the film as well, which I really wanted to do. But then it was realizing that my first priority really needs to be to the cast, to support the performances. So that's when Frank Buffone joined the project as the DOP. But it meant that we were, I think, very, very in touch. And so I was really conscious of what the limits of the actors were and often sort of gave them the opportunity to push those limits, but empowering them to ultimately decide. So an example was there's a particular scene in the film where a certain actor is at a great height standing on the edge of a building.
Oh, God, that day.
Yeah, and at the time, we didn't think we would actually be standing on the edge of a building, but the actor really wanted to do it. And there is a hilarious photograph, which, and weirdly, he had a friend who was living in the apartment building.
We're talking about, like, 40th floor.
The location. That's the wind. And he texted a photo of Tim standing on the building, and it looks terrifying. And no wonder, about 5 minutes later, 16 cops showed up on the on the rooftop,
because
going,
it looks like he's trying to kill himself.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
But may I just quickly interrupt and say he was heavily roped and tied.
Of course, yeah.
Right, but let me just say that for the listeners at home. But that didn't mean me as the actor who's trying to stop him
mm-hmm.
wasn't fucking freaking. It was frightening.
It was scary, yeah.
But I mean, a great look. But literally scary for the actor, and we know accidents happen on set, and you know, we had to do it again and again. But literally we had a couple of people, and thank goodness, who were in apartments saying, texting the police saying, I think someone's jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cops came up, and we've got this hilarious photo where me pretending to be a cop, I'm like, g'day guys, Constable Stewart, how you doing? And they're like, are you an actor or a cop? And I'm like, bit of both.
Yeah.
How you going? It's all safe here. This is the director. This is our safety officer. And but really, they did the right thing and came to the top.
Yeah. Well, when you're crafting something, I'm in the middle of a novella, and I just love the way, at least I think it's smart.
Writing one?
Yes.
Great.
I think it's kind of witty, and I'd love to hear how it sounds to somebody else outside my head. But if I'm getting this quote right, it's a lump of lead in the back of the head.
Oh, yeah.
I just love the way that comes out. It's such a, you know, how much fun did you have crafting dialogue? What was something that you thought it was good, but then once you heard Aiden say it, or, you
well,
know,
it starts
or Tom
being,
say it.
It starts up being my dad's phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's an old police thing.
Okay. It was slightly different. I can't remember the original phrasing that was written, but it was hearing Chris Haywood say it. And when he said it, he phrased it. I think he changed a word or something, and he said, isn't it better that it's this? And I was like, hell yeah, man, that sounds perfect. And then from then on, we changed it.
And the changing too also happened in rehearsal. So I said, well, what if his daughter says it too? Because it's something that's said around the house.
Mm-hmm.
If you fuck up, you're going to get a lump of lead to the back of the head,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is also, we had another one, Welcome to the Shit, which is something that Chris had said. And then I thought, well, if I'm obsessed with my father, which she is, she idolizes him and despises him in equal measure, then she would have all his terminology. And then they seem to get passed down to every character, which is really something that happened organically on the set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And the other one was Chris Hayward's line, wakey, wakey, hands off snakey, which
yeah, yes, which got a big laugh the other night.
Well, that's actually something that he says in the film Razorback, the classic Australian 1984 film.
Yes, he's been around forever, yeah, yeah. Chris.
And so it was nice to have this little, really subtle, you know, for the film geeks out there, reference back to
the Easter egg.
The Ozploitation, you know, genre era.
Yeah.
Well, taking Aussie cinema to the new millennium, the new world, what's next for Body Blow? I mean, you had the world, there was the world premiere here.
Oh, whoa. Thank That's you amazing. So world. It's really exciting. We traveled all the way over here.
Yeah. Well, we are going to really give it the time that it needs to play festivals and to build an audience. Mm-hmm. We're going to be releasing it theatrically in the summer in the US and around about the same time in Australia and in other countries. It's had really good take up in terms of international distribution as well. Mm-hmm. It's always you never know
what's in the lap of the gods. But yeah. I suppose what I could say, having done festivals before, Dean and I were shitting ourselves before the film plays. I mean, anyone who says they're not shitting themselves before a premiere is a goddamn liar. Because there's 1,000 yes men in your world who can watch your final edit in a suite and go, it's great, everyone's going to love it. But it's not actually up to the team to love it. We make a film for the audience, don't we? We make it for the film goers. So, we were stressed. And when we sat at the back and watched and the first person laughed at the first joke, we could take a deep breath and go, okay, so they get our sense of humour. And then when they gasped at something that was shocking, we went, okay, so they're invested. And so it's a real experience to watch an audience watch what Dean has been working on essentially for 3 years. Mm-hmm. That is a great joy. It's like doing live theatre. And you don't get that on streaming at home. You might get a review online saying, yeah, I watched it, I loved it. And it doesn't mean anything. But so the greatest thing about going to a cinema and still watching it is that the buzz on this film is already really high. People want to know about it. People have checked it out. And to have already got some reviews saying, to Dean's absolute credit, that this is a queer, contemporary film that is a great romp and scary. I mean, it's a huge credit to you. I mean, you aim for these things and you hope that someone gets it, and they seem to have. So what's next for Body Blow is to get more people to see it.
Well, I think there's a difference between yes men and people who believe in the project or the process. And it sounds like in order to get what we saw, you had people who were passionate and believed.
Yes.
I don't think that there's filmmakers that I won't name, but I feel like you can see a point in their career where they stopped having opposition and criticism and they just got what they
Sometimes
wanted.
Sometimes it's too much money too. I mean, we have this thing because, we're a small group of filmmakers in Australia and we always punch above our weight internationally. But there's something that they always say about Australians is because we get, we don't have the budgets of North America, it means people work harder. And I don't mean that in a showy-offy way. It means if you've got less, which is what this film festival shows, is you have to push it as far as you can with the least that you have, which makes you passionate because you're like, I want it to work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Whereas sometimes you'll hear about a filmmaker on their third film and they get a huge budget from someone and they kind of don't make as good a film because it's sort of a little bit too easy. Like the Raka Raka boys who made, Talk to Me, they still won't make a film in the States yet because they know if they stay where they're from, they'll push themselves more. Do you agree with that sort of thing?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we had a, obviously, we were completely independent on this film. So, and it was my decision to write a script from scratch, an original script, and then make it. And no one else sort of like said, Dean, here you go, make a film. So there was really only one motivation for me, which was doing it the way that I wanted to and making the film that I would enjoy watching. And certainly, you know, that we did have three other producers on the thing. But ultimately, you know, it was me signing the checks, you know, the buck stopped with me. I have the final say over everything. And that can be a dangerous and scary situation in one sense because that means that you rely on these incredible collaborations. I mean, something I'm so grateful for with your work, Sasha, and particularly, you know, you were very strong coming in and being hard on the script, and you would call me out on stuff and there would be a tension and I would push back and you know, to an extent with the other cast as well. That was the point of sort of like positive creative tension as opposed to someone who's signing checks coming over my head and saying you must do it this way.
Yeah, or insisting on a rewrite that is about something they weren't in the rehearsal room. They have no idea. I think what was great about Dean is it was a bit more like a theatre rehearsal on a new play or a new script, as you say, but now I love my character. Why would she say that? And he said, because I wrote it and it sounds good. And you go, it's a joke. It's a joke. But you know what I'm saying. And you go, well, could not.
How's the air up there, Dean?
Yeah, no, but that is what you do in rehearsal, in plays, on a new work. And I suppose maybe that's why I was hard on him, because I knew he could take it. Because what's the point of having rehearsal if we're just going to shoot what he wants? See you on the day. Mm-hmm. I'll put my clothes on. I'll see you there. But you wanted us to say what works, doesn't work. Not all directors actually want that. Mm-hmm.
And of course, there were times when it was just about like, I really need to explain to you why it needs to be this way. And of course, that's so important, because then on the day, you know, everyone's prepped and we're on the same level.
And I distinctly remember an interview with a director who had worked with Dr. George Miller on the latest Mad Max, or the second last one. What's his name? Tom Hardy. And he had the audacity to it was sort of an arrogant backwards compliment where he said, they got to Khan and he went, oh, now I see what you wanted to do. And I'm like, well, yeah, I imagine shooting a massive film like that, there'd be so many things where you, as the actor, would be a tiny part and you wouldn't quite understand until it was all assembled and see it. But with Dean, we were part of it. It was a small crew. It was a tight shoot. There was no money. We were pushed for time. And that brings you together, right?
Yeah, battle through adversity. Or art through adversity. And there's no atheists in foxholes, right?
Yeah. But I think it was hard. I think in the edit in particular, you know, like, you know, it could have been a longer film, you know, and you have to wear your like producer commercial hat, like, you know, is it going to be you know, ultimately better for the success of the film to kind of shrink back and make it a fast-paced ride, or do you want to make the, you know, 120-minute version that as a writer director you would on one level prefer to see yourself? What can you do?
Well, there are a lot of takeaways, and I think that speaking to directors and actors and people who actually do and make the stuff that we love on screen, what was the thing that kept you up at night, and maybe after you see it on screen, you're like, oh yeah, we made the right decision? Or is there anything that still keeps you up and like, oh, I can't stop thinking about that one thing?
Yeah, I think the one thing was throughout was getting the audience to really invest in the central relationship between Cody and Aiden. And that was the thing that would always come up at screenings. Have we got the audience on that level? Because one of the challenges here is that the characters are also deeply flawed. And none of them are designed to be sympathetic characters, but you nonetheless, of course, have to invest in them and have a sense of empathy for them. So unless you believe in the stakes, the emotional stakes of that central love story, then I think the film falls flat. But I must say, seeing it here on Friday was very exciting, because you could really see that people were, you know, as Sasha said earlier, you know, they were like, did they make it? I had people come up to me and go, so what do you think happens after the film? Do you think that they make it? Yeah. And they're like, really, they care about that. Yeah, so I was pleased with that.
And I think also often people talk about unsympathetic characters or an unsympathetic type. Sometimes, and maybe this is the type of festival we're at, you know, Fantastic Fest genre films, people are not pleasant in most of the films that we're watching, is that I think our audiences are now sophisticated enough not to need a person to be a good person to barrack for them.
Definitely.
So no one is a nice person in our film, but there is a lot of empathy that we hope our audiences invest enough to go, oh, someone said to me afterwards, well, she did her best. And I was like, yeah, she did. She did. She, you know, she, it's not her fault that she didn't know what happened to her mother. And I'm like, good. So you got that. Good. Tick. I thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's nothing better than hearing an audience tell you about your backstory. Then, you know, Dean's done a good job and we've done a good job. Mm-hmm. And so that's all you're really hoping for, is that apart from the laughs and the glamour and the craziness and the whatever that people are, it doesn't sound like much, but to be invested in the emotional truth of these people, all of them, is important. You should feel a little bit shitty if someone dies, even if you hate them.
And I like to think of, like, Guy Ritchie movies, I like them because everyone's bad. Everyone's flawed. But you kind of just, you want the best for everybody. Yeah. And even despite what they're going through, it's like, I hope they make it. There's another film that played here called Luger, about two stepbrothers in a criminal endeavor. And the further they get into this, like, they find that there's meaner people everywhere than them.
Right.
And so it's like, none of these people have probably ever done a good thing in their life, but you don't want anything bad to happen to them. And so that's the key to...
And also, I think that's reflective of ourselves, isn't it? Because, you know, it's really fun watching a hero in a film or in a rom-com, or someone who's really attractive, who is better than you. We can identify and project ourselves onto that. But there's also something fun about watching someone who's a fuck-up or flawed, because so am I, and so are you, and so is Dean. And so we then go, oh, okay, good. Not everyone's got it together either. Maybe not to the level of our body blow people who are, you know, carrying guns and there's drugs, but we identify with not getting it right.
Well, let's do a three-handed high five. Here's to fuck-ups.
Yeah, fuck-ups.com.
Exactly.
Well, Dean, Sasha, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for bringing the movie here, and I look forward to catching up with you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss it.